Gearing for boosts in round two.
Thanks for the invitation, everybody. So this is a more or less a preparation talk for round two. So I know there's a lot of things that I could talk about, but I need to give a few things of fine print. So I am a member of CMS, but and so therefore, for lack of time, I'm not going to mention or focus on any Atlas results, although there is basically the same conclusions that one can draw from their results as well. but as because I can't stand sort of phone book talks where you give, you know, name, number, it drives me crazy. So I want to, instead of then giving a sort of motivation theory and experimental work, I really want to give this a more coherent treatment in some sense. So this will seem a little chaotic, and there's not going to be, it may seem a little unorganized, but there is a method of my madness, and there is a lot of cross me that's happening here. I'm also an experimentalist, so my field theory is quite limited. So you can ask me some questions, and I will try to answer the best I can. But if not, I will defer to anybody who knows the actual answer. there's also a very large number of things to present. So if I haven't presented your favorite topic, it's not because I don't like it. It's just I'm going for a particular narrative here, I would say. So one important thing to remember is Run 2 is here, so it's not coming, it's here. This is the LHC status as of this morning. So you can, this is the training for all the dipole magnets. Basically, they're almost up to 6.55 TeV for all of them except sectors 3, 4, and 4, 5. But they're almost there. It's 6.34 and 6.15 that you see that. And the first beams that are going to be circulating around all of LHC is next Thursday. Wait, today is Tuesday. Next Wednesday. but there already actually are collisions. So LHCB and ALICE were both able to see collisions that already occurred. So this is already happening present tense. So this is the CMS detector. I'm sure everybody has seen this picture before, but not a whole lot has changed for between the last their last run and the current run. We replaced some of the modules for our pixel detector, but the majority, and we did a little bit of electronics upgrades for our calorimeter, but I'll defer an upgrades talk to another time because the majority of our upgrades will come in the so-called phase one, which will occur in the middle of LHC run two. So there's about four different timelines that need to overlap for this, but I won't spend time on upgrade technologies. Yeah, I am. Yeah, very quickly. So the way that the CMS detector works, it's the generic multipurpose spectrometer. The collisions occur if you look at a sort of a cutout like this. I like to use this in terms of a reconstruction of how we do stuff in terms of how we do things at CMS. We use this so-called particle flow technique, which utilizes all of the detector elements. So you start off in the center and you have some tracking. We have a tracker. Actually, we have several trackers, but we have a pixel related tracker on the very inside. Then we have some strip trackers on the at the next level. At the level after that, we have the electromagnetic calorimeter. Then we have the hadronic calorimeter. But one important thing to remember is that the 4 Tesla magnetic field is coming into the board in this diagram. This is the superconducting solenoid. So this is the solenoid itself. The return yoke is actually interspersed between our muon chambers. So our muon chambers are out here. That's what you see when you're looking at any picture of CMS. The majority of what you're seeing is our muon chambers. it does give muons this characteristic S-shaped curve, which is, so muons are our middle name because we're the compact muon solenoid. This is all. They're also our logo. Oh, I missed my logo. Got covered up somehow. This is on the logo. This is when you see these little swirly things on the CMS logo. Those are what muons look like. Working sort of inward, electrons are sort of the next easiest thing to look at because they bend in our calorimeter tracker, so you can contract them. Then they give a splash in the electromagnetic calorimeter, and more or less nothing else. Photons are the equivalent, except that there's no tracker. Or no bending and no signal in the tracker. Hadrons are actually reconstructed with a multiple level of multiple levels of information. We have the tracking information. We have a little bit of a splash in the electromagnetic calorimeter, and then we have a big splash in our hadronic calorimeter. And then we, of course, have the neutral hadrons, which are not bending, and they don't leave a track, but they do give a big splash. So in order of sort of ease, you know, how easy things are to reconstruct, muons are the easiest to reconstruct, then comes electrons, then comes photons, then charged hadrons, and neutral hadrons are basically the tough ones. CMS is happily taking data. We're buttoned up. We're taking cosmics. We are turning on our magnet on Thursday. Please don't break anything. but we're currently taking data, and we will be ready to go soon. This is our downtime plot. You can see that, or our uptime plot, which is 100%, and we're basically at 0% downtime right this minute. Obviously, this will slightly change when we actually have collisions, just a little. But we will. But we're actually pretty much ready to go. We'll be starting off our magnet testing for a week before we get collisions, and then we will be able to show you collisions already in about 2 weeks. So I want to give you a brief overview of the excitement that everybody should be having. So if you haven't seen this before, this is a parody from my postdoc and a friend of ours, my postdoc Jim Dolan and a friend of ours, Nyan Tran from Fermilab. About the restart LHC. So this is part of the LHC Fermilab education and outreach program. So this is these two postdocs who are making a parody of the Saturday Night Live skit where Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon are actually making fun of hashtags. And so this is the, let's see if we can hear. Oh, we can't hear anything. Okay, how does this? Let's see, maybe I need to do magic. It's plugged in, but I swear.
Ask your microphone if the audio is on.
Yeah.
Is the audio on?
Yes.
Here we go. Where is the audio? Here we go. This is the controls. Presentation.
Very dangerous thing you're about to do.
Yeah.
I'm an experimentalist.
Check me out, put the audio in your computer. Maybe that's it.
Oh, that may be true. Let's try that before I start breaking things. Where are we?
So the eye of every room is equipped with a local god. Normally, if you just speak up, they'll fix
it. Hello?
Yeah,
there, Creston. There we go. That work?
Shut the audio again. There.
Thank you, God.
Hey, man.
Hey.
So you pumped about LHC Run 2? Nope. Hashtag wind.
It says mute on my computer, but. Yeah. Okay. Well.
Why don't you just disconnect the audio output?
And be very quiet. Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Don't forget to stick your mic.
We'll try that for a moment.
But now it's complaining again. We'll get there. Balance, volume, loud.
Hey, man.
There we go.
Hey. So you pumped about LHC Run 2? Hashtag the anticipation is killing me.
So excited. I mean, in LHC Run 1, we discovered the Higgs boson. Hashtag Higgs discovery. Hashtag Independence Day 2012. Hashtag Nobel Prize.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to top, but hashtag we can't stop.
Hashtag we won't stop.
Hashtag party at the LHC.
I mean, there's still so much we don't understand about the universe. Hashtag dark matter. Hashtag dark energy. Hashtag naturalness. Hashtag metastable universe. Hashtag the nature of gravity.
Yeah, the Higgs discovery is just the hashtag tip of the iceberg.
I mean, we do have some ideas on how to solve some of these mysteries. Hashtag supersymmetry, hashtag warped extra dimensions, hashtag hidden valley, hashtag unparticles, hashtag two Higgs doublet models.
Hashtag technicolor, hashtag psych, hashtag SF, hashtag JK, LOL.
Yeah, the increase in energy to 13 TeV is going to be a real game changer. Hashtag double the energy, double the fun.
Yeah, the more energy you have in that proton collision, the higher the probability they'll create a new particle. Hashtag parton distribution functions, hashtag Bjorken scaling, hashtag color confinement, hashtag Skittles, taste the rainbow.
I mean, we're also increasing the collision rate. Hashtag 25 nanosecond bunch crossing, hashtag instantaneous luminosity.
Hashtag mo collisions, mo problems.
Hashtag true story. Hashtag pileup, hashtag in time pileup, hashtag out of time pileup. I'm not worried. Hashtag we got this.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Hashtag epic, hashtag CERN.
We're so lucky to be working at the LHC.
Hashtag blast. Hashtag summer 2015. Hashtag let's get it started. Hashtag jock jams. Hashtag whoop, there it is.
Hashtag all that and a bag of chips. Hashtag colon capital D emoticon. Hashtag Yahtzee. Hashtag LHC run 2.
Hashtag get back to work. Hashtag now.
Hashtag play is gonna play.
Hashtag hate is gonna hate.
Hashtag shake it off.
Hashtag shake it off.
So this is now officially, I think it has about 30,000 YouTube hits. It's officially the most popular thing that I've that has happened out of my particular grant. So so we'll give it a shot. Okay, so now run two is here. Let's not worry about too much from the past. Because it may distract us from what we're actually seeing. But okay, we need to learn a little bit about what the billions of dollars we just and thousands and thousands of person hours that we've done from here. But so I'm going to try to motivate the way forward with what we've learned for the most part in run one. So the question that one question on everybody's mind is whether or not naturalness is a thing. Basically, is the Higgs mass what it is? Is that an accident or a necessity? And of course, this is the hierarchy problem. Of course, the search is on. These are, I think, all of them. Well, no, it's not all of them. There were three that were posted last night that I talked about. I'll talk about very briefly later. So nothing is available yet, but there are some hints. So I'll talk about those briefly at the end. But I want to be very, very clear. This is not a doom and gloom talk. I'm not going to be depressed. We discovered something awesome, and we will basically have things to do and money for the next 20 years. So that's good. For my personal philosophy about naturalness, I had a bit of soul searching after the Higgs discovery, and I was wondering whether or not my conceptions, because I honestly was not on the Higgs boat. I didn't think the Higgs was going to happen. I was like spin zero fundamental scalar. Come on. So I was basically like Stephen Crane in the poem, a man said to the universe, "Sir, I exist." And the universe, however, replied the universe, the fact has not created in me a sense of obligation. So the universe didn't really give a shit one way or another whether I liked the Higgs or not. And therefore, I've learned my lesson.
Make the contextual remark that you're being recorded.
Yes, we're going to be online.
As long as there's no children, then I think I'm okay.
It's Canada.
I'll try to refrain from the cursing. But anyway, so obviously, as you know, the solution of natural solutions to the hierarchy problem are enormous. All of them are all of them are interesting. All of them are hard, and many may in fact end up bearing fruit. But today, I'm just going to focus on a specific class of models. It's not even a specific class of models. It's a specific class of topologies that basically result in standard model particles that have a high Lorentz boost. And in this case, if I say boosted, I mean high Lorentz boosts, which is a gamma factor of something larger than 2. So how often does this happen, and what are the typical boosts you can see? So you can look at something like a compositeness or an extra dimension model or a SUSY model where you have heavy vector bosons or heavy Higgses or heavy top quarks or something, basically, or energetic top quarks, and something that decays into standard model particles that have a mass, but they're moving relatively quickly. So if you look at something, something like a heavy resonance decaying to TT bar or VV or Higgs-Higgs, The boosts that you're talking about, let's say you have a resonance of 2 TV, the top quark boosts you're looking at is around 5. The W boson boosts are something like 13. Even for some natural SUSY models, you can get boosts of the top quark of up to something like 4. So these are, you know, just to give you a sense of the scale, these happen pretty often. And I mean, these are perfectly natural things, and they're important for us to look at. So LHC is all about the boost, actually. So it turns out that if you increase the energy from 8 TeV to 13 TeV, you get something like 2.5 times higher fractions of boosted, even just boosted standard water particles that you would in LHC run 1. So just for a sense of scale, we got 800,000 tops in 1 inverse Bentel barn, we're going to get 800,000 tops in 1 inverse Bentel barn, and we're going to get about 10,000 boosted tops in 1 inverse Bentel barn. So 1 inverse Bentel barn is basically where we're supposed to be by the end of the summer. Okay, so by the end of the summer, we should have about 10,000 standard model boosted tops, and most of which we will collect on data on our actual triggers, and so we're actually getting this. So we basically double the energy, double the fun in terms of boosted the boosted regime. We're actually even getting more than double the fun. So we're getting about 2.5 times the fun. And also just to remember about furthermore about that boost, we're actually we put our boosted tops. I mean, we have them in our DQM at this point. These are no longer experimental objects. Yep. Gamma 2 for tops. Yeah, gamma of about 2. So yeah, I mean, it's still a small percentage of the total cross section, of course. I mean, the tails increase a lot. And then basically just the parton luminosity scaling of a 2 TeV resonance is something like a factor of 10 to 15. For 3 TeV, it's something like 20. So you're looking at a huge, you know, huge increases in the tails. But we actually have boosted top quarks that are actually going to be sitting in our DQM, we have triggers that are based on this. So it's gone, and you know, within the last 8 years or so, it's gone from completely experimental idea to, yeah, let's calibrate our detector with these things. So there is way this field is human is become enormous. So I can't even list all of the references, but I just give you a sampling of. A few of the things that I will show today in some kind of context. But obviously, you're never going to be able to read this, and I don't expect you to. But I'm just going to basically, instead of giving you the full details of all of boosted stuff, I'm just going to sort of sum up the high points as I can fit into a specific narrative. So this is a slide I stole from Gavin. Pretty much. So this is in 2013. So you can see that even in 2013, we were already at a stage where we're having huge, you know, huge amounts of activity. So basically, three main elements were kind of coming at the time. So more or less, sort of matrix element level clustering. Excuse me. And we had basically jet declustering algorithms and also some kind of jet shapes. These are all. There's no hierarchy here in terms of. You know, progression of utility or usefulness or whatever. This is just an organizational, it's a kleidogram, I would say. This is the evolution of all these various things where the ideas were inspired from. So there are some omitted taggers, maybe some arguable links or whatever, but you know, you can obviously see that even in 2013, we had a huge number of things that were available. In 2013 and now in 2015, we've even grown rapidly. So we've also included an entire new category, which I'm going to call analytics. I'm going to spend a little bit of time of analytics, and we've actually gotten some sort of a priori first principles understanding of some of these things, which I want to kind of focus on a little bit. So the taggers that we've actually developed, there's a lot. This has basically become a bit of a cottage industry, and I think I've looked at about 6 million rock curves in the last 10 years, just related to, you know, boosted stuff, or maybe the last 7 or 8 years. But anyway, so on the left, I'm just showing the boosted top tagging. I don't expect you to take any single one of these curves and remember what they are. These are just the curves that CMS has actually just looked at, either in Monte Carlo or in data or in both. So this is for W. This is for top tagging. This is for V and Higgs tagging. The way you read these curves is that the efficiency to mistag something is on the y-axis, and the efficiency to tag something correctly is on the x-axis. So good is down to the bottom right. So these are better stuff. This is the same thing over here, except it's called mistag rate instead of efficiency B, and it's on a log scale. But again, down and to the right is better. I don't expect anybody to keep track of any of this. I don't think I can keep track of any of this at all. But one thing that's important, I think, is that I do want to spend some time on is this idea of sort of jet analytics. So in the last maybe 3 years, there have been really major advances in sort of first principles understanding of what these techniques are actually doing. So I think it's important to spend a couple of minutes thinking about this. So it really gave us a basis for sort of theoretically sound and, well, maybe theoretically controllable techniques. These are actually also informing some decisions for the experimentalists. So we're taking some, some motivation from here and actually putting it into good use. So the first thing that we need to understand is the jet mass. So all things about boost are really about measuring the mass at some level and then looking at the substructure of jets. So if you look at next to leading order and you just try to calculate the jet mass and you just have a gluon that splits the QQ bar, you can get the mass at next to leading order, and it basically has a load a log divergence that basically is at low mass. It scales approximately linearly with the momentum and has some finite cutoff from whatever jet algorithm you're looking at, and you just look at some size parameter r.
Your brackets means that the C bar depends on PJ over
protest, right? C bar.
That's a function.
This is a function. Yes, yes. So, I'm sorry. This is a function. Yeah. This is in Ellis, Houston, Katekiyama, Locke, and Tanisman's paper. But basically, you can see that if you're just looking at the mass over the energy, for instance, or mass over the momentum, you'll see this sort of divergence that occurs when you have soft collinear radiation. That's basically not described at next to leading order, and then you have this sort of flattening, and then a cutoff due to the size of the jet algorithm. If you look at this in data, so this is a similar plot, but this is now instead of the mass over the momentum, this is just the mass itself. So this is a distribution from CMS data of the unfolded distribution of the jet mass and digets. Okay, so these are all different. Energy regimes, different energy bins, basically, and they're multiplied by a factor of 10 by each time, just so they're all on the same plot. These are all really just, it would just be marching across the screen as you saw this.
So if I look at the first line, for example?
Yeah, this is the highest PT bin, so this is multiplied by whatever it is. It's impossible to read. It's 10 to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this is multiplied by 1, this is multiplied by 10, 100.
So you're taking all the jets with a certain PT.
Yeah,
in the first line, and you plot the distribution in mass.
Right, and so I show the data in the points. I show the and then I have Herwig unfold this. So the unfolded data are the points with the yellow bands as the uncertainty, and I have the prediction from Herwig Monte Carlo in blue. Okay, so you can see that as you would expect, the tails are well described because these are getting to the regime where next to leading order is sufficiently well described, and you're looking out towards here. But obviously, there's in real life, there is no divergence. There's a Sudikoff peak where this starts to bend over. So the next to leading order picture never captures this because you need another gluon in order to do that. So by definition, your next to leading order doesn't do this right. So. This one.
Right. So
yeah.
The average is fixed, but the same distribution is very broad.
Yeah, that's right.
So do we have analytic understanding of what the distribution is?
No, you mean the width?
Look, maybe a related question. The x-axis there is MJ average.
Yeah. MJ average is the average jet mass. It's the average of the two jets. This is a digest sample, so this is the average mass. So there was some discussion about what we actually should plot here. Right.
So that's showing the distribution of the, right? It's It's not the average of all jets in that bed.
No, this is the average of the two jets in the diget sample. Sorry if I didn't explain that clearly.
Suppose I take the event with two jets, and I take just one of them, just so that there's no ambiguity. I take one of them, I do what you do. I take all of the guys with a given PT and put them in one beam.
Right. It looks the same, basically similar to the average of the two.
So it's what is this distribution?
What is this distribution? I'll get to it in the next slide. So let me just give you actually, so. So the one thing that you can take away is that the Monte Carlo is well describing everything at the high mass, because these are basically when the partons or the particles at the end, they're well separated. Next to the leading order is good enough. Obviously, as you get to the low end, the Monte Carlos are starting to disagree with the data. But that's because this is just Herwig. This is not expected to get anything at next to anything higher than next to leading order, okay. But now let's take at something that's next to leading log. Okay, I'm putting this in quotes because it's actually modified next to leading log, but I'm not good enough to tell you why. My field theory isn't good enough as to what the actual modification really formally means. But you can look at the paper from this paper right here. But the understanding is as follows. So if you take just quark jets, for instance, from Pythias 6 Monte Carlo. Okay, for just for now, I want you to focus on the red distribution. So this is the same, basically the same thing that I just showed you last in the last slide. It's the distribution of the jet mass, except now the x-axis is on a log scale, because you're really now we're everybody agrees out here. Even the Monte Carlo agrees out there, the data agree out here. Now we're trying to actually really zoom in on over here and see what this non-perturbative stuff is going on. So this is from Monte Carlo, which agrees more or less with the data, but at the very low end, it's not all that wonderful, but at the end of the day, it's close enough. If you actually just take a look at the next to leading logarithm, the modified next to leading logarithm analytic calculation, you actually get curves that look just like this. So you can actually see you can calculate the Sudokov peak. B, we're actually agreeing more or less with the Monte Carlo. And C, this is completely an analytic expression. So you can actually just write out what this is. And so we've actually gotten this point to this point where we can just literally calculate this from first principles and just write this down. Okay, so this is a monumentally hard task. And this is all these guys have really spent a lot of time to get this done carefully. So while this is, so this actually can help us to understand a lot about what we have been doing and what we want to do. And I'll go into that in a second. But before I go, are there questions? I saw a couple people holding their breath for a second, so.
So what's the importance of, I'm trying to understand it. So you have the red line and then you have the trimmer.
I'm going to go into these in a second.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
For
the narrative of the talk, I could have just blanked out those for now, but I'm going to talk about those in a minute.
So I should compare the two red lines between the two plots and say they look similar?
Right.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay, so we're starting to understand the jet structure here just from the jet mass. That's good. The next thing I want to talk about is basically this jet grooming. So the tagging boosted stuff and jet grooming basically go hand in hand. There are many things on the market, and the sort of three that are somewhat popular are so-called trimming, filtering, and pruning. The way this works is that you take a jet that's sort of wide, and if you want to call that the master jet or the fat jet or whatever you want to call it, you recluster in some way to get to the inner substructure. And so trimming and filtering will both recluster with some other algorithm. And with a smaller R parameter. Then you can actually keep a certain number of them. So for filtering, you keep the N hardest. For trimming, you remove the ones that are soft, and you put it back together. And this ideally removes this soft collinear crap. And, soft collinear stuff. And puts back and keeps all the stuff that's interesting for hard physics. Pruning is a slightly different approach. It actually reclusters entirely, and at each stage, it actually just removes soft and low or wide angle emissions directly at the clustering stage. So it has a slightly different sort of philosophy, if you will. But these are the three things that we want, that we use very often. One quick synopsis is that, but more or less, they all work. If I look at any given jet, and I look in this same diejet sample that I showed you a few minutes ago, if you look at the mass that you groom, after you do this jet grooming that I just, from the last slide, and you take the ratio of that mass to the mass of the jet before you do any grooming, you get, you know, some fraction. So you can basically look at the unfolded data, which are you know, shown in the points, and you can compare it to various different Monte Carlo schemes. But basically, you know, the moral of the story is they all work. They all have some weird features. So this one's kind of you know, peaky. This one's kind of peaky and broad. And this one has two peaks. More on that later. They all basically, all the Monte Carlos are basically reproducing the data, more or less.
What I mean is that the red and blue are compared, I should compare them to the black?
Well, no, the points are the data, the lines are the Monte Carlo prediction. The black, red, and blue are the three different trimmers, that are groomers that I just showed. So this is filtering, this is trimming, this is pruning. So for a really long time, we didn't understand what the differences really were, because we were all like, well, they're all doing more or less the same thing. Why is this giving slightly different behavior? But it is kind of giving you what you would expect. You're getting less mass from the groomers. And whatever is happening, the Monte Carlo is capturing it.
OK, so the point is basically, yeah, you're saying your Monte Carlo fits the data if you apply the same grooming technique for each.
Yeah, it's basically that whatever physics is going on, the Monte Carlo is capturing it. So whatever it is, it's somewhere in, you know, Pythia and Herwick. OK, so it's not completely crazy. But really, we didn't really understand what was going on. However, so now we can actually look at a so-called Lund diagram. So we look at the logarithm of the KT scale for the algorithm on the y-axis, and we look at the logarithm of 1 over theta on the x-axis for these basically splittings between, you know, one particle going to two, or, you know, for your jet shower evolution. So these are plotted, so log of KT versus y. Okay. So large angles are over here, small angles over here, low PT is down here, high PT is up here. Lines of constant jet mass are just lines in this plane, okay? So the stuff that's in the center is soft and collinear. The stuff that's on the edge here is the hard and collinear, and the stuff that's over here is soft and large angle, okay? And then jet mass goes to here. So this would be, you know, mass of 30, for instance, whatever. So you can actually map out on this diagram what the groomers are doing. So you can just look at their cuts. So you look at trimming, pruning, and filtering. And this one has this a mass drop criteria, which basically I just want to talk about the filtering part for this purpose. But if you look at this, it actually just shapes this distribution in a specific way. So you're cutting out this region for the trimming. For the pruning, you can actually see this weird little bumpy structure, or this little polygon here that you're cutting out. And for filtering, you're actually just cutting out sort of a triangle. So so you can actually just draw what, you know, sort of the, in this phase space, which, you know, which regions of phase space you're actually getting rid of when you're doing these grooming algorithms. Now you can think about what happens to these lines of constant jet mass. So you, as you're tracking along here, line of constant jet mass goes this way, all of a sudden, there's an inflection point here. And so now something is different about the trimming. You'll see with pruning, there's two inflection points. Okay, so you can actually understand this, you know, if you go back to this previous slide, you can actually see the two inflection points that are happening. And so then now, so we actually have, you know, a firm theoretical first principles understanding of what's going on there now. And it's just because of the way that the grooming algorithm is actually getting rid of the sort of soft and collinear stuff and the different strategies to doing that. So you can actually just do this directly to understand what's going on. And you can analytically calculate all of these things, okay, just from first principles.
So what's going on in the case of filtering where you don't get so you're saying that the inflection point would just be the right angle?
For filtering, there is no inflection point per se. Okay, because we're not actually putting any cut. You're just getting the constant jet mass is just this way. The only inflection point you can, I guess, you could think of is here. You would get a slight inflection, but it's kind of a slight bending, basically. But there's no hard cut. Like for trimming and pruning, you have these weird polygons. And for filtering, you get this this triangle. Okay.
Right, but if we were to vary Z cut, wouldn't we reintroduce a polygon?
Yes. So yeah, exactly. But if that's the case, you can actually get you're getting close to what trimming is. So filtering and trimming are very similar approaches. One is just taking the hardest subjects. The other is taking the end hardest. Okay, but they're very related. So, and you can see this is where their relation lies. So you can actually calculate these things from first principles. Not only that, you can sort of understand the shortcomings of all of the approaches and come up with something, you know, theoretically more controlled. Okay. So so the next step in the behavior. It's to do a similar Lund diagram, but of course this paper has the axes are 1 over, the y-axis here is 1 over the previous. So this is log of 1 over z cut instead of log of z cut, basically. This is still log of theta, of 1 over theta, but there's an r parameter here. But now they actually just look at sort of slopes of constant, constant slope, and you can just change this slope. We're just going to call it beta. So going up this way is soft. Going that way is soft and collinear, and going this way is collinear in this metric. But you can vary this beta parameter. So beta greater than 0 goes like this, beta equals to 0 goes like this, and beta less than 0 goes like this. So the nice thing is that the soft drop, this is the so-called soft drop algorithm, this has a simple behavior in this plane. Okay, so there's no weird, you know, polygon that you're cutting out. It's just a line. But unlike the filtering, you can actually vary this. It's just basically taking filtering or something equivalent to filtering and just changing the slope of this line in this plane. So instead of just looking at one kind of slope, you can try to vary this one parameter, and you have theoretical control over this from start to finish. Okay, so you've got everything that you need. So the soft drop algorithm, the way this works is that. You take some jet, you cluster it with whatever you want, and then you recluster everything with Kamer-Jochen, and then you undo the last stage. Okay, so this is the typical step that you do when you're doing substructure. And if you just label those two subjects J1 and J2, if you have this metric, so you have the minimum of their PTs divided by their sum. If that's larger than z cut of the distance, the angular separation between them. Divided by your R parameter, raised to some parameter beta. If you get this condition, then J is soft is dropped, and that's where the soft drop name comes from. So anything that's soft gets dropped. Otherwise, if it's hard, then you redefine J to be the harder one, and you keep iterating until you get to the bottom. Okay. So what this actually does is, if you actually set beta equal to 0, you recover this mass drop BDRS filtering tagger. If you set beta equal to 0, and it always removes soft radiation basically entirely, and so soft, you know, soft here has a formal meaning. Okay, so that's in this Lund plane, everything that's above here is dropped. Okay, and so this has a specific formal meaning. So how does this look? So we've actually taken a look at this in data. So we've actually tested the cases of soft drop beta equals 0, beta equals -1, beta equals 2, and we looked at this. These are three signals, so these are all basic. So these are W bosons from boosted tops, and this is basically background, so a background enhanced region. You can see that there's still excellent agreement between the data and Monte Carlo. This is not an unfolded measurement, but at the very least, you can see that the Monte Carlo are reproducing the data very well. This is just to compare. This is our run one standard baseline tagger, which is our jet pruning algorithm. This is just the W mass also. But you can see that the behavior is well reproduced. But basically, this gives us sort of a, you know, I don't want to say a better alternative, but it gives us an alternative that has better theoretical control. Okay, so if we now go back to the to this diagram, you can actually see all of these inflection points that are happening as you're walking through this Lund plane. you can actually see all these inflection points and all of this behavior. It's exactly theoretically or not exactly, but it's all the rough points are agreeing where qualitatively basically, and you can. But the advantages are if you're doing this, this is from first principles. This is from Monte Carlo. And now that we have this soft drop, you can actually get a sort of nice behavior in this way. Okay, this has theoretical advantages, but also has experimental advantages. We rely on stuff down here to predict the stuff up here. Okay, so we have some assumption when we're doing our data-driven background techniques that there, we're looking in this region here where things need to be sort of linear. So we're looking at the tails of the distribution and just doing an extrapolation. And then that's basically how we're hoping that our backgrounds are well modeled. So it does give us even some experimental advantages.
So the formula at the top, this is corresponding to the red line, right?
That's the red line. That's right.
More complicated for the
as you can imagine, the other equations are more complicated. So you can, but it's all right in the paper.
And is there an understanding of the difference between the red lines look very similar to me? I don't know. It's maybe my eye is not as good, but. Understanding the differences or
so the major difference I think is in the pruning. For some reason the analytics are actually saying that it's directly along this line here, whereas the actual Monte Carlo has this slightly above and there's a bit of a slope. I don't have enough field theory expertise to understand why this is, but
so
if you're interested,
this is what I mean to make sure that things are more understandable. Is it the people who suggested the method feel responsible to trimmers
So trimming was done by Jesse Thaler, Liantan Wang, and company. This one is Murnau, so it's Dasgupta, Frezagoso, Simona Marzani, and Gavin Slaman. So I'll note that Simona has actually recently joined our faculty and will be here in the fall. So I think a nice perimeter talk from Justice, just all about this from a purely formal standpoint, maybe fun to hear. So you can do that in September.
Sorry, a very trivial comment about the difference between the two blue curves. They also seem to have different parameters according to the legends.
That may be true. Yeah, they are. This. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
It's Macintosh versus Empire apples. Yeah. Okay. Where was I? All right, so that's basically if you think about sort of one to two taggers. So these are things like W's, Z's, and Higgs. We've also got a lot of, obviously we've, the sort of killer app of all the substructure stuff is very highly boosted tops, which nobody believed us that we could do, and we did it anyway. Boosted tops are sort of are much easier than boosted W's and Z's and Higgs because you actually have two mass scales inside of the JIT. So that's nice, you can play around with them. So in some sense, they're easier. You get very, very clean signals. So we have lots of, obviously we have lots of results on these, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on them. But we have, basically the original CMS tagger, which is based on the Hopkins tagger, and then we have this HEP tagger. They've both been deployed in searches, and I'll show our latest, greatest results in a couple of minutes. But I want to also give some, some time to sort of analytics in terms of top tagging as well. So we have a really foundational first principle understanding of what's going on with all these grooming algorithms. We're even starting to have some sort of not quite first principles, but it's really getting close to first principles. Analytics of sort of shower deconstruction. So this is from Dave Soper and Mike Spanowski. So in this case, this is really trying to deconstruct the QCD pattern that actually happened in your observable JIT. So this is trying to go as close to the first principles understanding of the QCD of the problem and applying it to taggers. So this is one interesting, another interesting way that you can do this. So the way that you do this, and let's say you just have five particles that you're trying to cluster, or five microjets, whatever you want to call them, you take this Cambridge-Aachen jet, and you make some tiny microjets out of them with some size parameter. So you keep in this particular case, you keep at most nine microjets with PT greater than some minimum. And so in some sense, this is a combination of filtering and trimming from the Lund diagram standpoint. But what you do is actually take the approximate probability for each one of these splittings. And you can have two different hypotheses. You have sort of a signal-like hypothesis, which is over here for a top jet, and then you could have like a background-like hypothesis over here. And for each individual one, you calculate the probability or try to approximate the probability. I mean, you can in principle just calculate it all, but it's very time-consuming. And so to speed things up, they do some approximations. But then you can basically calculate the likelihood that it's signal-like versus background-like, and then you can start doing this. We don't have any results on this yet, but this is coming soon from CMS as well. But basically, yet another example where you have this sort of theory experimentalist crosstalk where you're trying to understand where things are going, and after you see what you see, you can think about it and really get some first principles understanding of what's going on. So there are other analytics that, in the interest of time, I'm just going to very quickly breeze through. You can do this for things other than the jet mass. So for instance, you can look at the sort of n-sub jettiness/energy correlation functions and things like this. And the take-home message, because I'm running out of time, is that things are looking also very good. But this is just to show you that this is not just applicable to the jet mass. So you can understand other things about jet structure. We also have a lot of work experimentally done in tagging bottoms in boosted jets. And so this is actually more of an experimental challenge than anything else, because everything is collimated and your tracking algorithms get completely confused. And so you have to be very careful. But the way that we actually solved this is that we did substructure. We took substructure on the jets, and you just look at the individual subjets instead of trying to disentangle everything. You can use the properties of the QCD jet in order to inform your B jet and say, no, don't look at that stuff over there. That's a separate QCD entity, whatever that is. And then the bottom jet tagger can just focus on this. And so we've actually spent a lot of time experimentally, and we got a lot of good progress done with this as well. Just as a quick validation that this works, the way we did this was by taking gluon splitting to BB bar and just trying to identify each individual B jet inside of the glue pair. So this is the delta R between the two subjets that are in some wide jet. You can see the gluon splitting to BB bar is shown here in blue, and that's the majority of the sample. But you can see pretty good agreement here, and we're very confident that this is a nice technique, and it seems to be working very well. Peter Scans has been trying to get us to unfold this distribution.
So
We did basically tag and probe on something else.
Okay.
But in this particular one, we looked at both of them together and just did data Monte Carlo agreement. So the actual efficiency measurement, we use the TT bar sample.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Boosted TT bar.
Boosted TT bar, yeah. Okay. Right. Okay, so now I want to talk about luminosity. So the challenge in run one was basically to mitigate sort of 20 interactions per crossing. And this is our pileup distribution. Overall picture, we made it. It was more or less conquered. It wasn't a problem. We did awesome physics, and that's it. Sorry? however, we have a bit of a problem on the horizon. So if this is the run one luminosity profile, this is the run three luminosity profile. So we have a bit of a long slog, and of course, when you have more collisions, you have more problems. But I think we figured out even ways to go forward here. So we must be brave and to get past this to accomplish our goals. Even in this field, there's way too many things that I can talk about. This is just a small sampling of the algorithm, the things we've looked at CMS for pileup mitigation. But basically, I want to set the baseline basically in run one with a sort of a similar cladogram that you could think of. It turns out, so of course, you can use this standard rho times area approach. So you just look at the amount of pileups that's in the event and multiply by the area of your jet and take the ratio. So that works actually quite well. You can also remove pileup tracks directly. So this is this so-called charged hadron subtraction or jet vertex fraction or whatever you want. We also found out that grooming itself, just doing this grooming, removes the soft and collinear stuff. Turns out pileup looks like soft collinear stuff, and so just grooming actually gets you some portion in pileup. There was also a lot of shape discrimination that we could utilize in order to make a lot of progress here. So just to flash a couple of slides, basically all of these things have been demonstrated to work, and they all work quite well. And so we were more or less, this is a check mark for run one pileup mitigation. Run two is actually we need to go farther, and so we're getting there. So we have our original grooming, removal of pileup tracks, the road times area, and shape discrimination. But there's a whole host of new stuff that's coming out. Okay, so this is So you can look at just to name a few things. So constituent subtraction is basically the road times area on crack, instead of looking at the road times the area of the jet, you're actually trying to define some road times area of the constituent of each individual jet. Okay, so you're trying to take this to the micro scale. Something called soft killer actually tries to sort of dynamically calculate rho by reclustering the event until basically your until your pileup level is the median pileup level is zero. There's also this so-called cleansing, which is basically a grooming algorithm and also removes some pileup tracks directly. You can also look at sort of two things that are more or less guilty by association. So if you remember the third slide I showed, we have these neutral hadrons that are sort of a plague when you're talking about pileup, because they're not charged, they don't leave a track, you can't remove them by hand. So you have to rely on some kind of shape discrimination in order to do this. But we know that they actually have to satisfy certain QCD criteria. Okay, they don't exist in isolation, so they have some probability if you're a neutral pion. A neutral hadron that's sitting inside of a jet. There's some probability if everything else is associated to pileup. There's some you're guilty just because you're hanging around with those bad guys too. So both the charge to neutral proportionality and this pileup per particle ID or puppy are trying to utilize these kinds of guilty by association ideas. There was a whole pileup mitigation workshop at CERN. You could look at sort of all of these techniques, and you just look at diejet events, and you look at the width of the PT distribution of the jets versus the bias that you introduce by doing this. So if you removed everything, your bias is bad. So better means you have a low you have a good resolution, which means the width is low, and your bias is small, so it's close to zero. You can see that a lot of these are all really performing quite similarly and all basically performing quite well. Just to pick one out, this soft killer is here in black. It does introduce a bias in the event because you're subtracting some energy, and so you don't actually expect to come back to where you were before. But as long as this is sort of linear, you can actually just calibrate that away. So this isn't necessarily a showstopper. Sorry?
Is it dependent on the overall energy? Is it a constant offset, or is it?
No, this is dynamic. So this depends on each event. So it's basically rho times area with a dynamic rho, or a better estimate of rho, whatever.
But
whatever.
You do it event by event.
You do it by event by event. So you have to calibrate this in some way.
What does puppy do
first? So puppy is a complicated thing because it's an MVA. So it's really hard to understand this, and we're in the process of this, but it's not a trivial thing. to flash some Monte Carlo studies. So this is an RS graviton decaying to WW, and all the W's are boosted and hadronically decaying. So if you just look at some PT range, the generator level that you get just from QCD and a perfect detector would be here in black. And you can see the various approaches here. More or less, sort of the green, which is PF plus puffy, the yellow, which is PF plus cleansing, and even sort of the CN here, which is PF plus constituent subtraction. These are all performing pretty well. what we did in run one was this PF plus charge hadron subtraction, which isn't all that terrible. Just doing PF particle flow, on the other hand, this will demonstrate that you're dead in the water. You certainly have to do something. What you do, it's still up in the air, but we're still studying this. But you know, at least we have more or less the idea of what to do here. Just if you want to just compare all the mass resolutions all at once, sort of quantitatively, you can look at the resolution in GeV versus all sorts of tuning for a couple of different things. So now we also looked at this soft trap algorithm again. Again, we looked at pruning and trimming, and then the combination of that with some grooming algorithms at the particle level. Okay, so we have so basically if you're looking at the differences in colors, the blue is particle flow. The green is if you remove the charged hadrons, and the red is if you use this puppy algorithm. If one of the what you really want is them all to basically be on the same line. So there's a sigma and an RMS of a distribution, so they're not exactly the same. But you can see that, you know, once you actually apply any particle level algorithm and you do grooming, basically you're unaffected by pileup. And so this is one of the things that we took away from run one, that we more or less have this under control in terms of substructure, so it's not going to be a killer. So don't worry, we're all good. So there's other boosty stuff in the end. So I'm basically out of time, but
We started late.
That's true. So let me just spend a few minutes on this. So I focused almost entirely on jetty things today. I could spend an entire other talk on other boosted non-jetty things. So for instance, we have once you have a lepton in the event, once these things are boosted, they get close to other stuff, and you really have to be careful about this. So traditionally, a W was defined in the Tevatron as an isolated lepton plus MET. That none of that works here. So you have to kind of redefine what you're doing. You need special triggers, which we've developed. You need a special reconstruction, which we've developed, and you also need some sort of special isolation. So Chris and a few friends from Hopkins were at one point worked on one of the new ideas that I like, which is this so-called lepton subject fraction. So this kind of combines all of these, all of these techniques into one, and applies them into some crossfeed between the leptonic channel. So if you look at sort of the fraction, so if you take a jet and you break it up into subjets, one of the leptons will be in one of the subjets, whether or not there's any hadronic activity there or not, is really dependent on whether it's a true lepton or something that's not really that lepton-like. So you can look at the fraction of this, for instance, and you can see, for instance, if you look at something that doesn't contain a lepton inside of a boosted hard prong, TT bar or Higgs event, you can see that here in red. But if you can see this lepton subject fraction for things that really have leptons, you see really, really good discrimination here. And this is basically recovering the sort of separation that you would get from traditional isolation in sort of non boosted topologies in the past. So this is actually becoming quite popular. It's a recent invention, so it's we don't have any results on it yet. I actually thought I might have it by today, but the analyses that are using this are not quite ready. But look out for this in the future. The next thing is also boosted taus. I mean, we've actually mostly been focusing on electrons and muons just because they're easy. And we've had our hands full with the jet side of things. However, boosted taus are starting to become important. So this, for instance, is a plot of a Higgs plus Z final state where the Higgs is decaying to two taus. And so now this is getting to be massive. And so the taus are actually getting collimated. So now you actually have to start thinking about this. The way that we traditionally reconstruct hadronic taus is we use jets, okay? So we're using the jet algorithms and then doing, mucking around with it until we figure out which is the one-prong or three-prong hadronic tau decays. So we need to actually, in order to move to the boosted tau regime, we really need to start looking into this more and more. So you have to start looking at, tau subjects, basically. This doesn't even start to begin about looking at sort of boosted tops that have taus in them. So, boosted tops that have leptons in them is our cleanest channel because they're easy. Well, we haven't even looked at the tau channels because they're harder. So trying to get to this phase is the next big thing. That's sort of the overlap between leptons and jets in some sense. So I didn't even have a chance to get into this at all. Just to quickly flash our run one wrap-ups. So we hot off the press as of a week ago. We actually finished our run one legacy Z prime to TT bar search. And we actually, this is an exclusion curve of the Kaluza-Klein gluon mass. Basically at 3 TeV, this actually turns out to be really the kinematic cutoff when this thing can be honestly construed as a particle. Anything higher than this, it really starts to look like a contact interaction. And the low energy, you actually get more of the signal is actually in the tail of the Breitwigner peak because of the parton luminosity enhancement. So actually, less is in the actual particle resonance mass, and more is off shell. So it's barely a particle at this stage. We've basically excluded almost to where it's not a particle anymore. Which is kind of nice, considering they didn't expect us to be able to do this at all. So yeah, take that. We also have coming soon, we have a run one Higgs-Higgs and Higgs-V papers that are coming. We also have a little bit of excitement in the boosted regime with a VV analysis. So we have a VV analysis, has a bit of an excess here. So if you look here, you see some collusion of a couple of different channels that are all kind of peaking at 1.8 TeV. We'll actually answer that question before the year is out. Because they're so high mass that the LHC run 2 will just blast this away. Because I was awake late last night, several hot off the press items happened. So this was at 11 p.m. So the CMS Higgs-Higgs analysis actually came out. So this is again using two Higgs, both radion decaying to two Higgs. Both Higgs are boosted. Both decay to BB bar. This actually came out. Sadly, we saw nothing. I can say nothing against, not much more about this because it was late and I went to bed.
What is the plot?
This is the Higgs-Higgs mass. So this is a radion mass, basically. So you're looking at X, some radion decaying to Higgs-Higgs. The two Higgs are going to BB bar.
So both sides of BB bar, and you fully reconstruct the...
Right, exactly. Much more I can't say because I didn't actually read the pass. But I've been following this analysis up until maybe a week and a half ago. But this is information as of 11 p.m. Also about 11 p.m., Atlas actually came out with their VV analysis. So you can actually see that they have a little bit of an excess, but they didn't really have the common decency to put their excess in the same place as us. So sadly. The excitement is somewhat lessened, but c'est la vie. Then this morning, actually at 2 a.m. in the morning, and then I didn't actually this one I found up after I woke up. So then we actually we just released our Higgs V result. This one's interesting because we even looked in the Higgs to WW decay channel. So boosted Higgs going to WW all jets. Okay, so now this is four subjects instead of two. Okay, so this is the first time we actually looked at this. This is the n. This is the four subjettiness divided by the two subjettiness ratio. So this is the first time this has also been used. This is just the validation in the data just to show that it's more or less working. Unfortunately, again, no accesses yet. But it's still early in the day. Maybe we'll. We may have something else if you give me another chance in a couple of hours. Now, Morion is next week, so everybody's cramming the results in as quickly as possible. Okay, so a couple of the other excesses in the last maybe minute and a half. We have a couple of things, so don't lose too much hope. We have a couple of things that are going on. We have our SUSY dilepton sort of edge search, so you see this slight excess in the same the opposite sign dilepton's channel here. We actually see this in a couple of different event selections. So you see some moderate excess, something about the 3 sigma range. We also have this sort of 2.5 maybe sigma of, if we just look at 4 leptons that contain a tau, not on the Z peak, with B jets at low HT. You'll also see a slight excess there. It turns out we also have two different analyses that are EEJJ that also see excesses, except they're not the same events. And they're not the same event selection, and they're not even the same hypothesis. One is a leptoquark hypothesis, and the other is a W prime hypothesis.
So you assume there's not the same
These two are inclusive. Yeah. So, okay, there. These also have a small excess, but these are all, okay. So I if you actually do the math.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, there's a similar paper that came out from Atlas about the first thing.
That's right. So it's not in the same place either. So it's, it's we really got to start coordinating this. That's the goal here. Anyway, so these are, this is just really just to, you know, avoid pain and suffering. You know, everybody also always complains because we never put out our, you know, 2 sigma and 3 sigma, sort of 2.5 sigma, you know, things because nobody understands what they are. It's true. I mean, we try, but what ends up happening is, like, this paper took 2 years to review, you know, for instance, because everybody's trying to make sure that everybody did everything correctly. But I mean, if you do the actual, you know, if you just assume that what we're measuring is all statistically limited, and you do the Bayesian, you know, you do the Poisson statistics of this, we should see way more of these excesses, but we by the time we beat the crap out of them.
Actually, in that direction, do you keep track of the deficits?
There, we do actually. Certain members of our collaboration actually have an analysis of this, but they're never going. They are intentionally never going to publish. Deficits get out easier. So, but I there is at least one person who is doing this privately that he will not tell anybody about, on purpose. He doesn't want. He doesn't want to actually do this because it's so much work to actually calculate all the correlations and all these kinds of things. It's a meaningless statistical number, but back of the envelope, it would be, you know, we're not reporting everything. Well, the right thing is to say that we're vastly overestimating our uncertainties by you know, because we're putting out pretty much everything, but it takes some time.
But isn't this artificially pushing out signals?
No, it's artificially suppressing them. The uncertainties are too large.
Meaning
yes, absolutely. That's right. It has to be. There could be some 4 sigmas floating around somewhere that we're really just not clever enough to extract. Okay, so in terms of run 2 startup, we're basically ready to go. We have V and Higgs taggers ready to go. We're actually opening with our soft drop plus N sub jettiness. Okay, so we're still using soft this pruning, but basically soft drop went from really came from theoretically the one that's most theoretically under control. We actually started. We're opening with that in run two. We also have our standard Hopkins inspired CMS tagger and our HEP tagger, which we've already been using. So those we're basically checking, and these are ready to go. We also have a couple things that are under development. We have the so-called multi-hour HEP top tagger and the shower deconstruction that I talked about. We also started looking at subjet quark gluon likelihoods and MVAs and all sorts of fancier stuff. So my introduction to run two, which is the conclusion of this talk, is that we're more or less ready to go. I don't sense enough excitement, I think, considering the going through run one startup. There was way more excitement about run one startup than run two startup. But we're still really, this is the second time in our life we've seen a factor of 2 increase in center of mass energy. We're the only generation in history that will ever see that. Okay, the next one will be at least 20 years away. So this is something to get excited about. You know, this is 2 TeV and this is 3 TeV. Luminosity ratios are like orders of 10 or 20. You know, big, these are big numbers. So let's not panic too much. So, but that's it. Any other questions?
What are your conclusions having production as
Because it's run two, that starts next week. That's not a conclusion. This is just the start. It's the end of the beginning, I should say. It's barely the beginning of the beginning of run two. But I'm excited. A lot of people, I think, don't share my enthusiasm. But it's not all dead, people.
Can you remind me? Okay, so luminosity for run two goes up to what? Then there's a shutdown, then there's an upgrade, phase one, then there's run three.
It's complicated because the LHC schedule is disjoint from the experiments. So the LHC schedule is that we'll have basically between two and three years of running currently, and we're going to accumulate something on the order of, you know, let's say up to 100 inverse Fenthal barns, depending on how well they do. Then they shut. Then the end of that is the long shutdown. The next long shutdown when they upgrade all the, you know, then they have to upgrade the machine. Then it goes up to the slow crawl to, you know, Atto barns, whatever. So you're getting to the. Then you're getting a large increase in the instantaneous luminosity.
So the sort of
Here is something around 40.
40.
Yeah, and then in run 3, it's 140.
140.
So, yeah.
And then you guys are going to start using tricks like timing.
That's the idea. So there's other stuff besides algorithmic things. I mean, there's machine stuff that we're actually looking at. So this is, you know, the almost all of our machine complication comes in this neutral hadrons. Our HCAL, if I get back to it, our HCAL is really, we put all our money in here. Okay, the ECAL and our tracker are very good. Our HCAL is not as good as Atlas. And that's mostly their timing is much better. So we're trying to mitigate this as much as possible. And, you know, a lot of the experimental work goes into this. And once we're actually done with the commissioning, a nice commissioning talk would, you know, could just be all about how to get rid of pileup, even from the actual detector side, which we're actively pursuing. All right, thanks for the invitation.